Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Well, we're joined by Ben Spees. I've got to say, it's a privilege, Ben, to be able to catch up with you. Slightly amusing story that you've just told me a moment ago. Whereabouts are you at the moment?
Yeah, I'm out of my ranch right now. I had to sit inside my truck because it's a little windy. But yeah, had to do it on the fly like this off the cell phone.
Because you were chasing a donkey.
Yeah, I was going to not say that on air, but we got to laugh about it. So my daughters, we've got two miniature donkeys, one big donkey and four horses that I get to tend to, you know, in my spare time, which I have enough of it. So it's fun. But yeah, she got out and got wandering around the property. So I had to go fetch her.
Modern day life, eh? And now I'm going to wind you right the way back to the beginning of things, if I can, Ben, just to get a little bit of background for those that perhaps are a bit not long enough in the tooth to remember the likes of yourself and what you've done in motorbike racing and what you're doing in motorbike racing. But your early career very, very rapidly became very, very fast from a very early age. And you had a fantastic career working with Suzuki all the way through the early years.
Yeah. I mean, you know, honestly, it was one of those things where, you know, I tell people all the time, Suzuki knows this too, but, you know, I wanted to stay with Suzuki my whole career, you know, and had a lot of good success with them. They were the ones that found me, you know, when I was 14, turning 15 and put me on the bikes and then progressed to the factory, you know, Yoshimura team and was able to win, you know, a few five championships, I think, with them and three superbike titles in a row. And then, you know, started doing some wild card stuff with the MotoGP stuff in 2008 and wanted to stay with them. But, you know, the GP team kind of had other riders and other plans at that time. And that's when Yamaha kind of stole me, I guess. And then, you know, was with Yamaha for the next few years.
The AMA years, I mean, I've got to say that from my memory, looking in at the series, you and Maladin teammates were at it. It kind of reminisced a bit for me of the Schwantz Rainey years, that unbelievably competitive pairing that were against each other every single time. Some of the closest racing that we'd ever seen in America.
Yeah. You know, thankful for that. It was at the time, it was tough. You know, and sometimes not always fun, but, you know, it made me a different racer for the future and for my career and taught me a lot, you know, it's hard to compare that to Rainey and Swantz because obviously that was pretty legendary, but in the same time now, I mean, looking back at it, you know, now that I'm almost 40, I can see what people loved about it. And yeah, for 4 years, 3 years especially, it was tough. And the relationship wasn't always the best. But I do got to say, you know, when it came to on track and developing the motorcycle, we actually worked really well together. And we worked close developing new parts, and we would discuss them. And but then when it came to on track, it was the tightest, toughest racing you could get. But also I trusted him probably more than any other racer that I raced against. And I think vice versa. We never pulled any dirty moves. I think there were only two occasions that we knocked each other off track, me to him and him to me one time. And it was literally one of those, you know, we just couldn't stop kind of thing. And it was, and we, the other person knew that. So now there was never any of that, you know, negative type racing. It was just outside the track and in the pits and in the 18 wheeler that it wasn't always, you know, so smooth.
Tough tracks though in America, great tracks. A bit like, I think I always think of America, some of the tracks there, like the UK, we have tracks here that you could never race world championships on. But as far as nitty gritty, tough racing, you got some great circuits over there.
Yeah. Tough, you know, really, you know, I'd say a bit, I mean, I hate to use the word, you know, dangerous in some ways, but just like you're saying, you can't race a lot of them in the world championship series, but just technical tracks and really physical. So it just, you know, it made it for when I went to Europe that everything kind of became a luxury, you know, with the tracks and safety and even, again, the physicality of the tracks. They were a lot easier to ride, a lot faster, you know, kind of more flowing type tracks, but usually more smooth and, you know, stuff like that. So it was, I mean, the training ground, like I said, I had, and you know, racing with Matt, the Yoshimura team, I mean, it was able to put me in a place, you know, where I could excel, you know, in Europe decently and do pretty well.
I mean, looking back, I mean, you're still a young man, you're not 40 yet. You've mentioned that already. Do you look at what's going on now? I mean, obviously, Rainey and co, Chuck Axland, they're working hard to make Moto America work. You're becoming a sponsor and a team owner this year as well. America slipped behind, which for me as an old guy, you know, I go back to Kenny Roberts Sr. when he first came to Europe and you just held your mouth open in awe, and then the Americans were coming and it was like one after the other. And that just drifted away over a period of time.
I mean, it has, unfortunately. I mean, compared to when you look at the 80s, you know, 90s, and kind of a little bit in the, it was real strong in the late 80s, early 90s. And then, you know, me and Nick and Colin did pretty well, you know, not quite as well as they did. But then, you know, obviously some things changed in America all at the same time, kind of in the, you know, 2009, 10, 11 ish. And it was a little bit, you know, the economy kind of dipped some. And me and Matt both left the series kind of at the same time. And I think that took a little bit away from it. And then, you know, also with one thing I always talk about too, is that we changed the elementary school for our kids racing. You know, we all grew up, I mean, you know, you look at Wayne and Kenny Jr. and Colin and Nicky and me, Hopkins, you know, we all 125s and 250s, you know, growing up. And now, you know, in Asia and Europe, it's still the same thing. It's just Moto 3, Moto 2. Where in America, there's not really much of that categories going on. It's more of your, you know, 400cc and your twins type classes and, you know, the smaller street bike categories. And when you're, you know, when you're 14 to 17 years old and you're not learning on a GP platform, you know, that's like ultimate grip, ultimate rigidity, super high corner speed, things like that, you know, you can't, I mean, you're just, it's a different elementary school than everybody else is going to. And I've always used the analogy of like, you have like an XR100 and you have a CR125 or a CR80. You can take the top five best people in the world. And if all they ride is an XR100 for 2 years and the other people are riding a CR80, you fly them over on a plane and tell them, hey, go match that. They don't know what the capabilities of those bikes can do. And it takes a while to get there. And I think that's been a pretty big key, you know, of why now, like present day, what we're looking at and why we're not there. But I also think that's, there's some stuff in the works, you know, that can change that. And we can kind of get back on that category. We got to do the same schooling that they do. And you look at the Asia Cup and you look at the Chiv series and, you know, then you look Moto3 to Moto2 and it's all in the similar type, you know, arena where we don't have that over here.
And yet, having said that, and that's 100% agreed with what you said from where our perspective here at OMG, that's for sure. But you're kind of heading towards that populist of the baggers series and the like as well, which is completely like the worst thing in the world to a Grand Prix rider, unless your name's Jeremy McWilliams, of course, who wants to race when he's 70, I think.
I think there's a place for it. You know, obviously there, in the very beginning of it, I was skeptical. You know, I was kind of wondering if it was something that was just kind of big right now. And would it be big in 5 years from now? But when you see Indian and Harley, you know, investing the money they have and making actual race bikes that you can buy, you know, made by them and things like that, you know, I started looking at it differently. And I'm not, again, there's kind of a place for everything, but we got to look at what we've kind of went away from. And that's where we've got to add that back to it. Hence the Moto3, Moto2 categories, you know, in America. So, you know, I don't want to, I am amazed at the lap times these baggers are doing, you know, and when you actually look at them in person, they're damn trick motorcycles. They are. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not something I would just want to go jump on compared to what I'm used to riding. But, you know, if the grids are full and the fans like it, then there's a place for it for sure. I just think that we need to, if we're going to have the conversation about, you know, when's the next American to be in MotoGP or winning in Moto2, that's a different conversation. You know, that's all there is to it.
Well, let's have that conversation now. Trackhouse have come, Justin Marks, NASCAR driver, NASCAR team owner, mm-hmm. Trackhouse Group have invested into the Aprilia, which was the RNF team, and have now disbanded them. And it's come out they've hired, you know, somebody from Suzuki originally, Davide Brivio, now as the chief man there as well, which is a really good call, really good shout. So they're obviously very serious about what they're doing.
Yeah.
The color scheme alone must stand the hairs on the end of your hands up on end, I would think, because it looks fantastic. Great expectations in America, I would imagine.
Yeah, and more importantly, I think he sees the big picture of it. I've spoke to him, you know, a few times, and actually about what we were just talking about what, you know, to have the next American, because he's heavily invested in it, obviously, now. We talked all about what me and you were just speaking about, you know, and that's why, like I said, I think there's some things in the works, you know, to make that kind of come back to America and start doing that. So, you know, he's in it at the right time. I mean, it's never easy to get into MotoGP, and with the RNF team kind of going away or the sponsor going away, it was the easiest to jump in, you know, and being with a European manufacturer, I think is a little easier to work with too, especially in the modern day, you know, racing. I think it's important for American racing, and, you know, how he goes about the sponsorship stuff, and whether it be, and I'm not saying he does, but maybe a Netflix type thing or whatever it is, you know, to get eyes on it, you know, I think is important. So no, it's exciting. And they've got a couple really good riders. So we'll be, I know, you know, Raul, I think he got hurt pretty good, you know, a couple weeks ago, but yeah, he's, like I said, he's got a strong team, and Aprilia is a manufacturer. When you see what Vinales and Espargaro are doing on them, they're good, you know, so he's in a good place, and hiring Brivio, everybody knows everything about Brivio. So that was, I texted him and I said, that was a, that was a strong move.
And the fact we've got a chief commercial officer now at Dorner, Dan Rossomondo, who's obviously an American that's come through basketball and the like. He knows his stuff. I mean, is this linking all of this together with what Moto America are doing, what you're trying to achieve with your new team as well, that you know, things are going worldwide, but it's everyone's looking at America to try and pick up the pace, aren't they? I mean, do you feel that Dorner are desperate to get the American market fired up again?
Well, yeah, and they need to be, you know, and we kind of need a little bit of their assistance in some ways too, which is fine. But, you know, it's a world championship and you need to have every, you know, country member kind of there, you know, you know, we're not, I mean, we've got, you know, Joe Roberts in Moto 2, but nobody in MotoGP. And, you know, like I said, it's, you know, with what Trackhouse is doing, again, Dorna knowing that and kind of what the stuff that's in the works, you know, I think for kind of next year on for America, this is an important time to put it all together. And, you know, with the Ray Hall group coming in, you know, to racing and what we're doing, you know, it's just, there's a lot of movement happening and hopefully that'll draw more, you know, teams in as well. And then, yeah, so we just got to take it from there, but everything's, you know, pointing in the positive directions.
What's done that with the car guys? I mean, like Bobby Ray Hall, you know, big in IndyCar, big drivers, big team owners, big money back in the day. I mean,
yeah.
Are they looking at the motorbikes because bikes are, you know, viable as a sport and a lot less cost? Are they redirecting some of their funding, you think, towards this stuff? Or is it just an addition to their portfolio?
I think it's just an addition. I don't think they're going to change anything, obviously, what they're doing. I think Graham's just really wanting to, you know, Graham's a big enthusiast. Bobby told me that they were, you know, pretty decent fans back in the day too. And, you know, Graham, like I said, Graham loves motorcycles. He's got two Ducati dealerships, you know, and he's a big fan. And I think he just, they looked at that market as something that, you know, they can get into and you know, hopefully do well at and go from there. But, you know, I don't think it's redirecting too much of their stuff. I think they're just, it's an addition, you know, and they're going to try to build and do what they've done in the car side.
You know how tough it is from a rider's perspective. I mean, I have to say that the Suzuki situation for me, regarding your career was slightly poorly done. I almost make the analogy, it's a bit like the Jonathan Ray situation for me, where Honda kind of kept him hanging on there for a factory MotoGP ride, and it didn't really happen in the end, and he went to Kawasaki and stayed with World Superbikes forever and a day. You were doing everything for Suzuki from a youngster all the way through, came right on, and then all of a sudden jumped across to Tech 3 because there was no choice in MotoGP. It seemed to me to be a great shame. I don't want to undersell it. I'd rather hear it in your own words. I mean, how did you feel about that? Did you feel you'd been cheated a bit by Suzuki, or was that just the way the mop flopped at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I do. And I always will. I mean, because I gave a lot to Suzuki, but they gave a lot to me. I mean, they did. Suzuki America and Suzuki Japan were great. But at the time, you know, when I was kind of ready to come on, you know, they had, Vermeulen was on the team and so was Caparossi. And, you know, I'd felt with, you know, coming in and I'd done two wild card races and one of them, you know, by the end of the race, not ever being on the bike and never being at Donington Park, they both beat me in the race. But if you look at the last few laps of the race and lap times, I was going as fast as they were, you know. And then when we went to Indy, I was faster in the wet and dry than them, you know, and finished, I think, fifth maybe in the race or sixth. So I kind of looked at it like, yeah, I deserve to be that second rider on the team. And, you know, not taking anything away from Loris, because Loris was a hero of mine, but he was also, you know, getting older and I was kind of hitting my stride and had won three titles for him. And they picked him over me. And there was a lot of other stuff going on, you know, at that time that wasn't just, you know, the Japanese as well. But, you know, I wouldn't say I felt cheated. I just felt like they made the wrong move and I wanted to stay with them, you know. But in the same time, Yamaha, they came in and said, you know, hey, we want you to go to World Superbike. And Mayo Marigale, who's a good friend of mine still, you know, he pulled all the ropes to make it happen, and we were able to go over there and then win a Superbike title.
You had a busy time, didn't you, swapping between a little bit between World Superbikes and MotoGP at one time as a wild card. I noticed that as well. You ended up replacing JT.
That was AMA Superbike and GP. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, I mean, it's still really busy to jump from the continent to continent and then style of motorbike to style of motorbike. You kind of proved yourself pretty quickly on a MotoGP bike. Then the factory moved you into when Rossi decided to clear off to Ducati. You replaced him. Big shoes to fill on that one as well. I mean, how did that all pan out? How did you feel about that at the time? Were the team cool and were they right behind you?
Yeah, so it was a tough situation because I was in World Superbike with Yamaha, and you know, we had a new bike, and you know, that year obviously there was a lot of new for me. I was having to learn all the tracks that we went to, and obviously trying to win the title, and I'd been back 88 points, I think, was the deficit that I was coming back from. And we get to, you know, kind of three quarters through the season. And, you know, Lynn called me and he said, hey, you know, what about GP? And at that point, you know, World Superbike compared to AMA Superbike was, I hate to say, it was a little bit easier than beating Matt, you know, in AMA. It wasn't easy, but it was just, I knew at that point that, you know, if I was on one of the top two bikes that, you know, we were kind of setting the bar. And, so I just kind of, I was like, man, I guess the natural progression is to go to GP, you know, and at that point, but I wanted to win the World Superbike title, and I was still, you know, catching up. I was still like 20 points back, but I had enough time to catch up and win it. But, you know, Lynn was kind of like, well, you got to make a decision by this point. And I'm like, well, what if I make the decision and then I don't win the title and I move to GP and I never won that title? So I was going to be upset. Luckily, everything worked out, you know, and I was able to win the title and move to GP. And yeah, I mean, take Rossi's place, who is the greatest of all times. And that's not easy shoes to fill. You know, and then later got kicked back out, you know, because he wanted back on a good bike. And that's, you know, we weren't doing the job well enough to be able to keep the position. And that's the way it was. But GP was tough. I mean, not going to lie, it's something I don't regret the decision at all. You know, somebody asked me that and I said, well, I mean, I could have stayed in Superbike. And let's just say I did win three more titles and I didn't go to GP. What does that do for me right now, currently, present day? Nothing. It doesn't, I mean, to me, it doesn't affect, I don't care. You know, some people, they would like to have them all stacked up and that's fine, but I was able to do well enough in GP that it made sense on the move. But in the same time, as a rider, and this is my fault, it's not the team's fault, it's nobody else's fault, I just was never able to be comfortable on those bikes, and I don't feel like I was able to get the most out of myself when I was there. And that's a lot to do with how I rode the bikes, because remember, the first Superbike title I won, we didn't have traction control, we didn't have that stuff. So I kind of got to ride the best analog, you know, bikes of the you know, ever. And then all the electronics took off, and the electronics, you know, they hurt people like me and Nikki a lot. And that's just, like I said, to each their own. And again, I place the blame on me, you know, it wasn't anybody else, but I just wasn't able to get on with them like I could a Superbike. And then remember, they had, you know, went to 800s and then back to 1000s. There's a lot of changes going on right when I went into it, and me being the size I was, which was the bigger, me and Simicelli were the biggest riders in the grid. Those 800s didn't do me any favors, you know, at all. You know, and then when we went back to 1000s, I thought that was kind of going to be my year in 2012. And that's when we had a string of, you know, horrible luck situations with the bike. And we had, you know, we had just little things like at Qatar, I crashed in practice and it cracked the subframe, which was the tail section. It's all one piece. And then they never saw it because it was in the inside of the tail section. And we get in the race and my race was ruined just because of that. And then we had, you know, we had an engine blow up at Indy when I was in second place, and we had a swing arm linkage fail at Laguna, and the bike broke in half basically, and had some real weird stuff go on, and just kind of, you know, it hurt that year pretty bad. And then that's kind of how it ended. But, you know, making the decision to go to GP, it's still one that, like I told you before, I mean, that's, I would have always done it. You know, it's, I didn't just want to stay in Super Bowl.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I've got to say, Ben, brutally honest, I've got to say that's there's some fairly brutal honesty in amongst that conversation you've just had there. I mean, and then it was topped off at the end of the day, obviously, clearly by how hard you were trying with the injuries that caught up with you in the end as well, which obviously you had to make a decision about the end of that.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, there was a few years after, you know, probably 5 years or so that I was pretty bitter, you know, about how it ended. Just with me. I mean, it wasn't anybody's fault, but, you know, then I just started looking back at it and just, you know, it's like, man, I had my whole career. And if I had, in essence, one bad year and then it's over, it sucks that it ended like that. But I mean, I had a lot of, I wouldn't say good luck, but I had a lot of good fortune, you know, in the whole meat of my career and the early times and all that stuff. So, you know, that's just the way it goes. And you grow up and you have kids and you see that, you know, all that, what life is. And it's kind of like, well, you know, that's the way it was. Wasn't that bad.
Huge files though, in the back of your head as to how to run teams, how to look after riders, the care that you need now, and look, using that knowledge at 39 years old. I mean, you've got a long career ahead of you as possibly a team owner, presumably aspirational to come back into MotoGP or one of the Grand Prix classes at a later stage. But how do you see MotoGP nowadays? How you obviously follow it quite closely just from what you said, but how do you see it progressing? We've now got sprint races on a Saturday, huge workload for the teams, riders we have little sympathy for, but the teams perhaps a bit more. It's a tough environment now from a working perspective, the amount of work that has to be done during the course of a year.
Yeah, I mean, I stay pretty up to date with a couple of the top team managers and stuff like that. And I can tell you it's not easy, you know, because when I was doing it, I think it was 16, 17 rounds a year, maybe 18. And now you're like 22 and you've got, you know, the sprint races. And, you know, I probably wouldn't love it if I was a racer right now. You know, that much racing. Not saying that some of them don't need to be double headers or something, but it's a lot what's going on. And then I'm not a fan of the aerodynamics, you know, I'm just not. It's getting to the point now where not always, I mean, put it this way. I mean, if Bagnaia was on a Yamaha, he wouldn't have won the last two titles. So, you know, the rider can do less to overcome the issues. And it's more about the bike. And I kind of back it up and just say like, hey, you want close racing. That's what everybody wants to see. It's not always about the lap times, and it's not, it's not about, I mean, I guess, you know, it is about the technology some, but you know, if you get a tire, I've always said this, if you get a tire and you take 10% of the overall, you know, max lap time off of it and you take it down a hair, and that kind of goes back to how World Superbike is, then every bike can reach the capability of that tire. You know, there's a long time, like with Ducati with the Bridgestones or, you know, vice versa, that the bike wasn't good enough to be able to push what the tire could do and the other bikes could. But if you went and put a different tire brand on there or a tire that was just slightly, you know, less on peak performance, the racing's going to get tighter, you know, and it's kind of almost like how rain tires are when a drying track. It's like the thing can only go so fast and the best riders are still going to make the difference in the end, but the field is going to get a whole lot tighter. And when they did the 800s to 1000s and they've done the ECUs and they've done all these, you know, huge money spins for manufacturers, if you wanted close racing, I mean, there was a lot easier way to do it. But, you know, technology is technology. I get it. You know, we're always getting more to the future. But now with the aerodynamics, I purely look at it like you can't use that on the street. Like nobody on the street can go fast enough to use that technology. Traction control, ABS, wheelie control, yeah, okay. But aerodynamics, no. It's like driving an F1 car on the street. And it's just, there's been so much money that's went into it. And if anything, I think they pull it off in the future. And I think it needs to get a little bit more simpler, you know, at least on the aerodynamic standpoint. All those, the ride height devices, lowering, you know, just some of that stuff. And, you know, because at the end of the day, the people on TV watching the TV, they just want to see close racing. That's what it's about.
Disappointed when we saw Suzuki pull out. We can only guess the reasons for that, but I would think it was funding and the way that the sport was heading in the direction. It seems to be quite a smart move that they've pulled out. But do you think these rules and the way that things are at the moment are restricting the way that other manufacturers, Kawasaki, BMW, perhaps, look at GPs? Do you think that's, you know, will Yamaha end up pulling out if they don't have a good year up to the next set of rule changes?
No, I don't think the players that are in there now are going to pull out. But I do think, you know, again, I think if the MotoGP bikes were a bit more 2015-ish, you know, 2014, like where they're still very capable bikes, that would, you know, would you have, you know, BMW come in sooner? Would you have like even Husqvarna start with something else, you know, too, which is kind of another kind of like KTM, or how, I'm not sure quite how that works, but it's similar. You know, but the way that it is now, you know, it's definitely, I just think it's headed a bit too much in the extreme direction. And I know Casey said a lot of stuff too about taking electronics completely off, which I would agree that they need to come down some, you know, but you can't take them away. But it is getting to the point where I keep saying like enough is enough. You can't, like all these fairings and all this kind of stuff. I mean, the bikes are going to be pretty damn ugly pretty soon, and they're getting that way now. And I mean, it's just the way it is, you know. And again, I just look at it, I know it's a prototype, you know, category, but you know, most of that stuff that's on the bike, you can't use it for everyday street use at all, you know. And I just think they need to dial it down a little bit.
Let's talk about modern day riders then, shall we? I mean, obviously you mentioned the GOAT, the greatest of all time, Valentino Rossi, retired. That obviously was a detrimental to the sport when it comes to the numbers at some of the Italian tracks and so on and so forth. But modern day racers, we used to talk about aliens, didn't we? The aliens, which started for me with Freddie Spencer, moved on to the likes of Rossi, Pedrosa, Lorenzo, Casey Stoner, particularly for me. Do you see aliens anymore? Do you see the riders of that kind of, Pecco Bagnaia obviously has won back to back, so that's not been done for a long time, but it's looking like the likes of Pedro Acosta coming into, you mentioned GasGas earlier on, which is a KTM effectively, into your old team at Tech 3. I mean, You see aliens, you see these superstars coming on to challenge that Bang Nia dominance?
I mean, I don't see aliens like it, I guess, like everybody used to, you know, think of them now. I mean, Acosta is definitely, you know, he's just, he's the fastest of the young guys, and he's going to get there a lot sooner. But again, now you look at how many different winners there are, and again, that's because the racing is closer. But I still think it's more, you know, it's not just down to the bike, but again, like if you put last year, if you put, you know, Acosta on a Honda, I mean, he's probably not going to do what he's doing now. So it's definitely a lot more bike related. But also the level of competition, I don't know if it's just gotten better, you know, or tighter, but there's just a lot more guys that can win, you know, now. And, I mean, again, you've got Martin, Cordararo, Bagnaia, you know, I mean, the list goes on, and it's just tighter than it was back when I was racing, for sure.
You kind of left out Marc Marquez there. I don't know whether you did that on purpose. He's moved to Ducati, obviously, Gresini. I mean, how do you see that panning out? Is he the same Marc?
I think he is, but I do think the bikes have changed a lot, too. And I do think the bikes are – I got to be careful with this one because – the bikes are easier to ride now, you know, physically they're tough as in whole, you know, just the G's and left to ride and the forces from braking and all the stuff because of the downforce. So I'm not saying they're easy to ride in that regard, but as in the bike sliding, the rider doing things to the bike to manipulate the bike on, to make it handle better, to do things like that, there's less of that going on than there ever has been. And now it's literally more being on a good bike, a good setup, and knowing geometry, how to connect the dots around the racetrack. And it's more like F1, where, again, it's more about the car, you know? And I just think with Marquez, you know, the bike's were harder to ride, or the rider could do more input to him 6 years ago than they can now to make that difference. And I think for him, I mean, he's got the talent. I mean, he's definitely still, you know, a top six talent of the field, or naturally could be still the most talented. Yes. But it's one of those things too, where he's got to learn or trust this new wave of bike after riding what he's been riding, which, you know, starting in 2016, you know, 2015, 16, it was pretty clear to me that the Honda just steadily went downhill. It did. You know, 2018 and 2019, the front end of it was horrible. The electronics, like, soon followed, and you could see it. And then he was just, the bike, compared to all the other bikes, it was pretty much junk, you know, I mean, and he was making the difference. When you looked at any other Honda rider compared to them, they weren't even in the same atmosphere as him. So clearly, you know, he was still at that level, but now he's got to trust the Ducati. He's got to ride the Ducati the way it needs to be ridden to be fast, and he's got to learn that. But, you know, I said it on Twitter, you know, a couple months ago too, that if anybody like really knows, and I mean, Marquez's talent, which he does have, and I'm not saying Bagnaia can win another one. And also Jorge Martin now is on a streak, but their styles and how they ride the bike and how their upper body is, on how they lean off the bike, the way that weight distribution is, that's kind of the newer edge of riding with using the downforce with the bike and just everything working together as a package. But I said it on Twitter that, you know, it's pretty scary, you know, if you're giving Mark the best or the second best bike with the year old bike, in 40 some odd races on a Ducati. I mean, that if I'm a rider, that I'd be kind of terrified with that.
So where do you see this year going? If we talk about MotoGP, I mean, who do you think are going to be the movers and shakers this year? Who have you got that tiny dollar on for the title? after a very long year in 2024?
It's tough. I mean, honestly, really? You know, I know Marquez, you know, he hasn't made too many friends too in the paddock with how he approaches racing and following people. And but I also put it down to he's kind of the ultimate competitor, you know, and he stays within the lines, but he pushes it. So with all the injuries he's gone through and what he's been through and what he's come back from and the risk he's taken to go to Ducati and all that stuff, I'd be lying if I said I didn't hope that, you know, he could pull it off. And I think it'd be good for him because, like I said, as a person, the dude's went through a lot, you know, and he's pushed himself and most couldn't have done it, wouldn't have done it. And he has. So, you know, I do silently root for him for sure. If you look at the last quarter of the season last year, it'd be tough to not put money on Martin. You know, I mean, he's just got to, you know, he's got to learn from those little mistakes. Like I think he already did where the one race when he was, it was somewhere over in Asia where he was literally like still pulling away like half a second a lap, even after he had got like that 3 second lead, you know, he threw that one away and that one cost him the title. But if he can manage those mistakes again, yeah, I think it's him or Bagnaia that wins the title, you know, for sure. I mean, they're just right now consistently, they're just on a bit of another level right now, for sure. But again, it's and I like Bagnaia. He's somebody that I kind of called a few years ago too that he was going to be the next guy to take the reins and win multiple titles. You know, and again, personally, you know, I'm a fan of Pecco too. But you know, if I'm just speaking, you know, off of what you see and performance wise, I mean, if Martin just doesn't make, if they both don't make silly mistakes and you look at the last quarter of the season, you'd have to maybe give the momentum to Martin, you know, right now.
I think there's a lot of people that have got money in that direction as well, Ben. Before you go, we've got to talk just a little bit more about your team, if we can, that you're obviously, and your aspirations, where you're headed over the next few years. I mean, I'm sorry to keep mentioning your age, but at 39, I'm slightly jealous of you still. And you've got such a lot ahead of you with one thing and another. You know, the team, name of the team, what your aspirations are for the future.
Yeah, I mean, it's Rahal Ducati Moto. That's the team. Obviously, our main sponsors are Expel and Roller Die. Expel's the PPF company that wraps all your nice cars and keep them, you know, protected. And I've got a couple of my cars wrapped with their stuff too. So great company. And, you know, we've got three riders this year in the super sport category. I was able to kind of pick the riders and pick the staff and the mechanics. And PJ Jacobson, Kaylee Yakoff, and Corey Alexander. And you know, PJ, he's won World Super Sport races before. He's won Superbike races here in America. And I kind of, you know, I picked him to try to go out and do the business, you know, the first year in the Super Sport class for us. And then year two, hopefully we add the Superbike. And with working with me and working with the crew chief, we have James Compton, I'm hoping that maybe the one or two pieces to that full circle that he's lacked in the past, we can put that together. And then when he gets on a super bike, he's going to be the man to beat. And then with Kayla, she's unbelievable. I mean, she's the fastest female we've ever seen ride a motorcycle. So, she's only 16. We just had our first 3-day test, at Jennings. She and PJ broke the track record. I mean, she was 0.2 seconds off of him, and she's 16. I mean, it's incredible. And, you know, with most of the girls that out, you know, are riding, you know, when I watch them riding very well, you know, I can see just a little bit of a difference, you know, compared to, you know, a Marquez or people like that. But with Kayla, you take that ponytail and put it away, I can't tell. I mean, she's aggressive, she's fast, and the feedback she gives is where I kind of was in my early 20s. I mean, the clarity she has and the feel for stuff and what she wants out of the bike, she knows. And it's her dad's done an incredible job developing her. And I've kind of helped her, you know, the last 4 years, just if when there's a left or a right to go, you know, he kind of calls me and he's like, hey, what do you think? So, you know, she's somebody that, you know, I think that, you know, in the next couple of years, she could win a super sport championship here, you know, against the boys. And you know, it's going to be interesting. And then Corey Alexander, he's a super stock champion, a past super stock champion a couple of years ago. And, you know, going to try to get all the best, you know, we can out of him. And all three of them working together, they're all different career paths right now. I think it's important and it's good for her development and, it's good for all three of them. So I'm looking forward to it.
With Kayla at 16 and your team moving them through and looking after them in the way that you'll be skilled at doing, obviously, I mean, presumably you'll be looking at Moto 3, Moto 2, moving her on into world championships, or will you move her through world super sport and super bike first? What would be your ultimate aim? What path would you take?
Yeah, I mean, for her, again, my goal would be to, you know, starting next year, be looking at, you know, kind of super sport championship type material here. And then after that, you know, maybe going into superbike here or going into world super sport stuff as well. I've talked with Ducati a lot overseas. There's going to be some racing for her overseas this year. Can't say quite yet where it's going to be and when. And then, you know, as soon as the age limit, she can run in world super sport, you know, we want to make that connection happen, whether, you know, I don't think it's going to be full time, you know, anytime soon, but I do, I truly think that, you know, in about, by the time she's about 18, 19 years old and developing the way she is, can she be a top 10 world super sport rider? Yeah. I mean, I see that right now. I mean, so, kind of the sky's the limit with her. And I just, right now we want to, like I said, progress here and do some of those races like she's been doing in Europe, you know, and keep getting that, you know, that under her belt. But I kind of think for her, you know, it's better, you know, super sport here than looking at super bike and world super sport, maybe world super bike, Moto 3, Moto 2, with the bike she's been riding, you know, in the past. And it's kind of, you know, it's a completely different avenue, but it's kind of like the Top Rack conversation about GP. You know, does he have enough talent to do it? Yeah, he does. Does he have the time that it takes to, you know, change his style to be able to be fast on a GP bike? You know, again, just like with Johnny Ray, I spoke with Johnny Ray a lot, you know, when it kind of came down to it. And it was like, and I wouldn't say, you know, it's not that he just took my advice, but it's like, do you want to go over to MotoGP and kind of be, you know, third place to seventh place guy and make a good living and have fun? But then after 3-4 years, you know, the young Moto2 guy kicks you out? Or do you want to build a legacy and do titles? And a lot of it's, you know, the way the bikes that they've been bred on and they've been on their whole life, and Top Rack kind of super stock bike to super bike. And, you know, if Top Rack never went to GP, I don't think he's hurting himself. And it's a lot of just, you know, where he's been. And if he does go to GP, there's got to be that time, you know, to fill the gaps and change some stuff about how he rides and things like that. And it has nothing to do with talent, nothing. Because I think Top Rack, when it comes to natural talent, he might be the best in the world or top three, you know, but there's just different styles of racing. And it's like Lewis Hamilton getting in a NASCAR. Can guarantee you he ain't going to win the first season one race if he doesn't. And it has nothing to do with talent. It's just a different way of racing.
Didn't your Justin Marks in Trackhouse, didn't he bring Kimi Raikkonen in for to NASCAR? I'm sure he did, actually. A former yeah, world champion he brought into NASCAR.
And I don't think he was in, you know, I don't think he was ever in the road course stuff. I think obviously it can be a little bit easier to be competitive, you know, quicker. And I think they liked it. But again, like when those guys have come over, I don't see they've ever been in the top 10 at the end of the race, you know? So, it has nothing to do with talent. It's just like taking, you know, Kyle Larson, go put him in an F1 car. He ain't going to be there. You know, can he get there at some point? Possibly, but it's time. And it's a different, you know, animal.
Ben, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Of course it has. And we could talk for absolute hours. And I think now we're drifting into NASCAR and IndyCar. Perhaps we will cut it off about there.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're never going to be out and round up all the donkeys you've got to go and catch in a minute.
I know.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very, very much for joining us. We really do appreciate that. And perhaps if you would, we could catch up with you later on in the year and find out how your riders are going and how your plans are going.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.